Welcome to SD Europe's podcast. For this episode, as a part of our For a Better Football podcast mini-series, we will be speaking to Alex Bielefeld, FIFPro's Head of Global Policy.
So today we welcome onto the podcast FIFPro's Head of Global Policy, Alex Bielefeld. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on. I'm really looking forward to talking with you. So today we're going to be talking about FIFPro's recent Playing Our Part report. First of all, many supporters will agree it's been heartwarming to see the contributions from players globally to tackling the effects of COVID-19 at various levels, which are highlighted in FIFPro's report. Many supporters have been working with their communities to get through this in the name of their club, so to many it's fulfilling to see players contributing also. So to kick things off, Alex, can you tell the listeners a bit about FIFPro and your position with the organisation?
First of all, it's a pleasure to be on the podcast of Supporters Direct. I started my professional career in the football industry actually with a consultancy for SD Europe. So it's great to be back really. So for everyone who doesn't know FIFPro or who just came across FIFPro very briefly as an organization, we represent professional football players globally. So we basically bring the voice of players and their views to the table on basically whatever effects or matters for their working conditions or simply their profession as a football player. And in that capacity, we represent roughly 65,000 professional players, male and female, across the global football markets through our members, which are basically domestic player unions in each of the markets.
Okay, so moving on from there, FIFPro's Playing Our Part report, which was released, was it July or August? End of July, is that correct?
End of July, yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So could you offer an introductory summary of it? And, you know, in the report, it speaks about player impact. Could you outline what that means as well?
Yeah, sure, of course. Look, I think at the beginning of the pandemic and the outbreak of the virus, I think there was very quickly an understanding that it had a fundamental impact on our generation, and not just our generation, but actually the generation of our parents, and it was unprecedented for all of us, right? No one had seen something like that before, even though it existed in human history beforehand. So for us, it meant that we could see that there was a very early on an incredible amount of individual and collective activism developing in our societies, which was very positive and helped tremendously in dealing with the first impact of the crisis, so to say. And we wanted, at that point already, we wanted to have a better understanding and a better feel on how players reacted to the crisis. And it took us a while to build a narrative, because we obviously had to observe what was going on in the market and how players actually responded. But we were in a debate or exchange with players through our player council or our domestic unions on a daily or weekly basis at that time. And what we obviously know is that players, athletes have always cultivated a strong sense of giving back, either through a very institutionalized setting, through, for example, the community initiatives of their clubs, or the programs of the league, or, for example, in some countries, through the federation. But at the same time, players have always also focused on their individual or collective initiatives outside the traditional setting of the industry. And that's not a big surprise, because I think obviously the way athletes socialize, the experience they make from a very early and young age on, basically cultivates a sense of togetherness and a sense for for collective action, basically, in a team sport. So in many cases, that translates also into activities and actions of the pitch, and certainly and particularly their sense of community and how they can support. So it was no surprise for us at all that players have developed incredible initiatives around the world to help, on the one hand, their communities, on the one hand, their teams and their teammates in many cases as well. But as I said, we felt we needed a framework to better understand that and to basically see what kind of impact players were driving context. So that was really the entire thinking behind playing our part report from the very early beginning of the pandemic. And then it took a bit of time actually to arrive at something which we would call a final perspective, which we felt was serving justice to provide a more fundamental outlook on how players have responded to the recovery of the pandemic. And just in a nutshell, I think that there are probably three takeaways from the report itself. The first one is that, yeah, sure, players were helping communities and people at risk in multiple ways through that crisis. The second one was, and I think that's maybe a bit more surprising for some people, that players have made also significant contributions to their clubs and to basically help clubs through that really difficult time, especially also in smaller markets and lower leagues where clubs were hard hit by the loss of match day revenue. And then we felt that is for us obviously something really, really important, is that the crisis took its toll also on players directly. And for anyone who has looked a little bit into the data we provide on the scale of the global employment market in professional football and its precariousness in many aspects, it is not surprising for when you look at that data that obviously players were hit really hard and immediately by the crisis, by loss of income, a lot of uncertainty for them, as for many other people in our societies, right? So that was really, I think, which came out at a very high level from the report.
And, you know, obviously before we spoke today, I've had a good read through the report. And I would definitely recommend those listening to have a read too. We'll put a link to it in the description of the podcast. And in the about section, you know, it talks about, you know, concepts of player solidarity. Is this something that you can speak further on?
Yeah. From very early on, in the outbreak of the pandemic, we saw that there was a public debate unfolding across several markets around the world on how we define solidarity for us as societies. And we simply wanted to provide with this report also a player-centric perspective on what solidarity and impact actually means from the perspective of a professional football player. And in a nutshell, I think there is no one narrative on that, because our industry is much more, is too fragmented for that. And every player will bring his own perspective to the table, which is mirrored and situated on his or her experiences in the industry and in their upbringing, of course, right? And where they're from. So if you talk to a player in South America, the way he will talk about player impact is probably very different to a European player growing up in Germany or England, for example. And then at the same time, we also saw a couple of interesting surveys and pollings on solidarity. And I'm not going to disclose the market, but one question asked people about which profession they believed was in a prime position to give back during that crisis, and was mainly mirrored around salary. Mm. And the first profession people came up with was professional footballers. Way before CEOs, politicians, other athletes, or any other profession you could think about, from lawyers to anyone else, right? So there was obviously an emotional debate going on in terms of what certain parts of the public were expecting from players. And we simply wanted to provide with this report also a more nuanced understanding on, and a more balanced way of looking at the profession of a player nowadays. Mm. And what basically, from a player perspective, it would be a reasonable way to contribute to the recovery from the pandemic, but also to leave a positive impact on the societies and communities in which they play or come from, right? So that was really one of the other perspectives and learnings we wanted to get out of the report.
For those that might not have read FIFA Pro's report, could you give a few examples of, you know, some of these contributions you talk about of what players have been working on?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, I think the first caveat I would probably need to add is obviously that whatever examples we included in the report is really just a tip of the iceberg. And as you can imagine, there are so many stories about players and what they do, which are not captured. Because, for example, they don't talk about that publicly, and they just do that for themselves and for the community. So what we wanted to provide in terms of the list of examples is simply a peek into what this ecosystem of player activities in the community space and during COVID actually looks like, and how diverse it is, right? So with that as a background, the first way players were really active and contributing to their communities and people at risk was really in their own social setting. And that was striking, that you had obviously a lot of players contributing through financial means, and that's then probably also what is usually reported in media, as much as players would disclose that. But you had of initiatives also from players which were non-financial within the community spaces. And that was really interesting to see just what kind of scale that had in terms of mental health support, delivering food packages, being involved in existing charities and solidarity programs within their community. And it's unfair to name any player, but just to highlight that, we had one player in the report from Morocco who was not playing in his home country anymore. And he was providing care packages for 1,000 families back in his home countries who Wow. suffered from the impact of the pandemic, right? And that was just 2 families afloat. And that would be the activity of such a player would be completely out of the spotlight of any European tier one media and what they would report on. And then on the second aspect of the report with regards to players providing support to other players in hardship situations, because there was obviously just one outcome of the pandemic. Players suffered immediately or had an immediate financial impact from the crisis, which put them in a hardship situation. And there we could, for example, see the player unions and players in Botswana in Africa, but also in Colombia in South America, basically providing, putting care packages together for female and male players in their country to just keep the players afloat and to kind of help them in their with regards to their emergency need. So we had a lot of these player-to-player solidarity examples as well, which was obviously from our perspective at the union, something great to see that was something which was, that collective spirit was also existing amongst the players themselves. And then last but not least, as I said before, the impact of the crisis on clubs and on the employment environment of players was obviously immediate as well, and players have a often very direct link to the employer and to the club. They come probably from the same communities or have a very strong link to that community and for the club they're playing in, especially in the lower leagues. So there was a lot of support also from the players towards clubs and to help with the financial impact and to mitigate that. We had great examples in France, for example, in Netherlands, in Costa Rica, how player unions and players collectively with the clubs agreed on how to basically mitigate and how to steer through the crisis, also with regards to a restructuring on a contractual side of player contracts.
You know, moving on from there, Alex, you know, many will assume that all players will come through the pandemic relatively unscathed from a financial point of view. But it would be interesting to hear from you, what has the reality been like for those players, maybe outside of the elite clubs, lower down the competitive pyramid?
Yeah, as I said already before, the employment market in professional football at the global level is extremely fragmented. And I think what supporters experience with regards to the sustainability and the fragility of their clubs, this is obviously something which is mirrored on a contractual side for the players immediately. So I think as soon as a supporter would have a concern about the club and would be concerned about the volatility in which the current club operates, the player will probably have the same feeling with regards to his or her contract. There's a direct relationship between that. So in general, when you look at the employment market for professional football players, it's very precarious outside the top divisions, in countries, especially in the smaller markets, but also in the lower tiers in some of the top markets. There's no question about it. And a lot of fragmentation also exists within leagues and often even between clubs. So I think the best example is that obviously the way every squad is composed, you will have players who just make their way into a squad from the academy level and at the very beginning of their professional career, while other players are transitioning out again. And all of these, let's say, stages in your career will affect the contractual side of the player and what he's able to secure in the market for him or herself. So it's very difficult to even just for one team to say, well, that's the state of play and that's the economic picture for team X, right? If you look at aggregate numbers, yes, of course, but then there's a lot of fragmentation existing even in the top markets within a team, for example. Now, when we look at how Corona impacted players, I think that the first impact is, of course, is on the health side. And that's not different from any other person in our society. Players were insecure about the impact of the disease. They were obviously exposed to it as much as any other person as well. I think also, especially at the moment when we see leagues taking up competitions again, especially in the lower leagues, we basically ask players to go back to a full contact sport while lots of us are still experiencing social distancing in the office space. For a lot of the smaller markets and lower leagues, we actually have no testing capacities available. So that obviously, until today, raises health concerns with the players. And then the second impact after the general impact on health was the financial impact, especially in the lower leagues, as you mentioned, Luke. So a lot of the players are on short-term contracts, maybe just a year contract, right? Maybe the year is running out at the end of the season. A lot of players experience late pay in some of the markets or even no pay in the market. So for them to go from 1 month to the other into a situation where they don't have any income and where they, in the best case, basically receive support via furloughing programs of the government. But in many cases, also that wasn't available for players. That basically creates, in many cases, a situation where players cannot take care of their family anymore, where they can't contribute to social security payments for their insurance, for example, or their healthcare. So we had a lot of players in hardship situations. And if you look at markets outside of Europe, that even gets worse, of course.
Moving on, is it fair to say that many of the difficulties experienced by players can be linked back to the fragility of the football industry? And if so, does FIFPro have any recommendations to navigate around this going forwards?
What I think is fair to say is that what Corona brought to the table is that we have a new debate and discussion in the industry on how we want to shape the industry in the next decade and across the next competition cycles. And sustainability is without a doubt an important aspect of that. And from a FIFA perspective, I think it's when you just look at the pure, or from a player perspective, when you just look at the numbers in the industry now in Europe, you can see that the industry has consolidated its financial performance. So since 2011, we have seen a constant increase in clubs becoming more sustainable on the financial side of things. And that is due ultimately to regulatory mechanisms and regulatory decisions on the licensing side, mostly. But obviously, we have also seen that income and revenues within professional football, especially in some of the key markets, have changed in the same period of time and have further increased. So we can say that we have already seen an improvement on the sustainability side of things. But what is important now are basically the next steps when we're looking towards the next decade of the football industry. And for us, sustainability from the player side is not just about expenditure. I think sustainability is something which we need to look very broadly at in our industry. It's something which concerns the solidarity mechanisms in our industry. It concerns the regulation and the transformation of a progressive transfer system and changes therein. It concerns certainly also the licensing side for leagues and clubs and financial expenditures. Certainly, and you can see that player salary becomes part of that debate as well. But it's important that we look at all these different mechanisms, including governance and how we basically make collective decisions in this industry. Because I think we can discuss everything with an open mind. It's just important that the different stakeholders are involved in these discussions and that these discussions are not taken lightly. And I think that is something where our industry has had huge problems in the past. We have seen that that has changed for the better already. But we can certainly benefit from more collective decision-making and more stability in the industry. And that includes an open debate on what sustainability must mean for our industry going forward.
Well, you know, this is it, you know, when it comes to the sustainability, the long-term future of football. Many supporters are concerned about the vulnerability of their clubs because of this financial culture of football, which operates on such fine margins. And, you know, some might say that's it distributes revenue significantly and evenly, which, you know, can impact the players as well. SD Europe is working for a more sustainable and fairer football. It would be interesting to know where FIFPro stands on this. I know you have spoken a little bit around this already.
Yeah, sure. Look, I think the player perspective is ultimately fairly simple. What we need in our industry for sustainable development are quality jobs for players. But that is not just financial. That is, a lot of that depends on the working and playing environment which players are exposed to. And that has something to do with the stability of contracts, that has something to do with, let's say, the access players have to arbitration. So there are a lot of other things which contribute to a positive playing environment from a player perspective, other than financial things. What we have to be aware, and I think that touches a little bit on what you just described with regards to a fairer and more sustainable football landscape, is that football has always changed. It has always been impacted by societal and systemic trends. And we have seen that in the 90s. We have seen that beforehand in the 60s. So all I want to say with that is that to assume that everything remains as it is and that the status quo of professional football will remain as is, I think that would be naive. I think that we will see changes again in the professional football environment, the global and at the domestic level. And we simply need to be prepared to navigate these changes collectively. We need to involve the different stakeholders. We need to have an honest and open debate about the direction we would like to go. And of course, that direction has to be sustainable. And of course, that direction has to be fair. But what that means in the nuances, I think that's what we need collective governance frameworks for, to actually discuss that with all the different stakeholders. Because as I said at the beginning of the podcast, the perspective from a club, the perspective from a supporter, and the perspective from a player, they might have all the same principles at heart, but their perspective will be slightly different. But that doesn't mean that we can't have a joint vision for our industry, because as much as supporters want to see their clubs to be sustainable and stable, first and foremost, the players want that as well. I think in that sense, we just need to be open-minded about where we are and what our industry represents.
Okay, well, Alex, that is about time. That's about all the time that we have for the podcast today. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear you talk, and I'm sure everyone listening will agree with me on that. Do you have a parting message or anything that you would like to leave, maybe about the report or any work that FIFPro are doing at the moment?
Look, I think we have way too much in common, and there's way too much passion out there from all of us for this industry and for this game, really, and for what some of us do on the pitch and for what some of us see from the stands, that it's way too important to not have a good working relationship and try to understand where the other side is coming from. Because I think everyone has really the best of football at heart. And that's what should drive our discussions. Thanks for having me. And it's always great to be back to Supporters Direct.
Thanks, Alex. So originally we spoke to Alex last month in anticipation of releasing this podcast this month. But since then, murmurs in certain circles regarding a so-called European Super League have cropped up. So we invited Alex back to get FIFPro's position on the situation, and he very kindly accepted. So Alex, thank you for coming back to speak with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Great. So we can go straight to the question. You know, recently conversations around the formation of a so-called European Super League have picked up again. From the players, or, you know, the players' union perspective, what's the view?
Well, first of all, I personally at least didn't get a call, and I don't think anyone else in our organization to discuss that matter. So I don't think that we have a formal view on that in particular with regards to the current debates. What probably is fair to say in general is that we will start playing the next cycle of European club competitions as of the summer 2021 to 2024. So that usually means that our industry is starting to think about the next cycle after that. So, and that's what we're talking about in the current debates is how will the competition design, competition structures look like internationally as of 2024 for the period stretching until 2027. And that is a usual process through which the industry has to go through. And usually, obviously, that comes with a bit of white noise and background discussions, especially in the media. And everyone knows that these discussions in and around different competition formats and whatever you reference as the European Super League have been there for over a decade or even longer. So it's not surprising that they will come back to the table in some sort of a format right now. I also think that it's the responsibility of the competition organizers, obviously, to look in various models of how competition should look like in the future. And I would be surprised if there would probably not be, I don't know, 40 or 50 different models on the table. That doesn't mean that they're all serious options at the end of the day, right? But I think it's simply the responsibility of the competition organizers to think about all of that. From us as a player union and from the perspective of players, it's obvious that there is an interest in that debate. And we have seen that through various comments also being made by players in the media in the past weeks or months. But it comes down to a couple of general principles which guide our thinking in that context. The first principle is obviously that the majority of jobs for players sit outside the international club competitions in Europe. And those jobs need protection, especially in the current environment. And there's a lot of solidarity amongst the playing community with regards to that principle. There's no question around that. However, at the same time, history also tells us that the top end of the game will also need to develop and that football will evolve and that structures might change over time. And I think I've said that also in our previous discussion, that it's a historic fact that competition structures have changed, right? So we probably will see some changes over the next decade coming back into the game. And that is not necessarily something negative. The second principle is that it is not the responsibility, first and foremost, lying with the players in the unions to develop competitions. That is a responsibility which sits with the competition organizers to a degree. They have the capacity for that. They have the people who can crunch the numbers. They have economic insight into parts of the markets where that is relevant in these discussions. However, obviously, wherever these discussions in and around competition structures impact the world of work and the quality of jobs players can attain in the industry, there obviously becomes a responsibility for the player unions and for the players to take an interest, a legitimate interest, to take part in these discussions and in these decisions. And then last but not least, and I think that is really important, especially in the current period, is that however we will structure competitions in the future, player workload is one of the fundamental criteria which we have to integrate in any discussion involving the calendar post 2024. And actually even before that, just looking at the emergency period in the calendar stretching until 2022, because what we see at the moment, and we just need to look into, so like the news which are coming out of the last international windows, the amount of player injuries we have is simply insane at the moment. The workload players are facing in the game continuously across various competitions without necessary in-season and mid-season or in-season and off-season breaks, the amount of back-to-back matches players are involved in at the moment. That is something which is not sustainable for anyone in the industry, from the career path perspective of the player, but also from a performance perspective, putting the performance of competitions at risk, and not just club football, but also international football, national team football. So this is something which, from our perspective, is a fundamental principle and has to be a fundamental principle in the revision of the match calendar moving forward. And obviously that touches on the structure of our competitions as well. So I think that is more or less where we stand at the moment, and the discussions will evolve over time. And we really hope that, especially on the safeguards for players with regards to workload, but also with regards to the protection of jobs across the diverse landscape of European club football, that this is something we will protect as an industry. There's no question about it.
Well, Alex, thank you. You know, I'm sure many listening will appreciate getting an insight into where FIFPro, you know, sits with this, and you know, what it takes from you know, these rumours and discussions. Alex, as ever, it's always a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you ever so much for coming back and chatting with me.
Thanks for having me. All the best.
Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Please do listen to the other podcasts in this mini-series in addition to the ones that we've previously published. To find out more information about SD Europe, head to www.sdeurope.eu.